Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're asking, why are we so morbidly fascinated? Some people dig music, others might have a soft spot for stamps, but there are those who are passionate about all things macabre. On the show today, we'll be meeting some morbid collectors who've spent their lives acquiring objects from the curious to the grotesque. Yeah, we know what dead is. But it's not just the avid fans that we're interested in. Aren't we all a little guilty of enjoying the thrill or the chill of a good horror movie? We'll be speaking to a professor who's been studying why we're compelled to watch things that frighten or disgust us. And later on in the show, we'll be hearing from Belgian artist Luc Toymans, who's put together an exhibition at London's Royal Academy all about one of his country's most morbid of painters, James Ensor. Seeing as it's Halloween, the only day in the calendar where being the creepiest character in town is deemed okay, we thought it was good time to explore this topic. So here we go. It's Culture with me, Robert Bound. First of all, we're going to New York to meet some collectors of the morbid. There are plenty of museums around the globe that showcase some of the world's stranger collections. Whether it's instruments of torture, pickled body parts, or bits of bone, these are objects that spark curiosity, although perhaps amongst some more than others. Clarissa Farr has been wandering the Big Apple to meet some of these people, including a curator at the Morbid Anatomy Museum, who has a penchant for taxidermy, and the owner of a shop called Obscure Antiques and Oddities, Evan Michelson. She sells all sorts of weird and wonderful items, from skulls to embalming equipment, and has a personal interest in wax mannequins. Why? Let's find out.
Well, there are objects that I buy for the business, and then there are just a few things that I end up keeping. And the objects I keep are the objects that resonate. So there's just something about them that draws me aesthetically, and they're telling a story that I want to hear, or they're saying something I want to know more about. The things I buy for the business are categorical: history of science, history of medicine, history of natural history, and then assorted quirky or beautiful things. And that's mostly my eye and my business partner's eye, and that's hard to define. You know, it's just something you'd like. But for myself, when I see something that I end up keeping, which isn't all that often, it just knocks me out. The beauty of it just, it blows me away. But I could not articulate why.
Could you maybe share the last thing that you saw, or just a particular item that you saw that had that effect on you?
I bought a 19th century specimen box of insects that were arranged in beautiful geometric patterns. And this is, I cannot resist these things. I don't know if you've ever seen one, because the Victorians were phenomenal collectors, particularly of the natural world. My business partner and I have been doing this for so long. It's been more than two decades. I kind of don't have favorites anymore. I love the natural history specimens. I love the things that were prepared more than 100 years ago. I love the patina on the wood, and I love the little handwritten labels. I love the age of it. But right now, it's like having a whole bunch of kids. You can't just choose one.
And we're also talking about this theme of, you know, kind of death, the darker side of things, which you talk about a lot. Could you maybe just speak a little bit about what fascinates you about that subject, especially as it's represented in some of your items? And what do you think draws people in general to those things, or that topic?
To the dark side, for lack of a better word, the slightly morbid, or it's definitely a way of being in the world. I'm attracted to mystery and quiet. So, like, I love spending a lot of time in cemeteries, old churches, anywhere where there's a lot of time and a lot of quiet. It's very peaceful. So I don't see that sort of thing as dark. I've spoken to so many people who agree. I'm introverted. I'm very much a loner. I like that sense of isolation. It actually makes me feel calm. And there's so many things that can be considered deathly, like postmortems or actual human remains. And I started out collecting memorial items, specifically things made out of human hair. I don't know if you've seen it. We have some here in the shop. And it gives me a great sense of joy and continuity It's other people's lives. And it's not just mourning, it's also sentimental. And mourning's an act of love. And remembrance, and we all love people and we all remember people, so to me it's not dark.
So I'm J.D. Poe. I'm the curator of the current exhibit here at the Morbid Anatomy Museum, which is called Taxidermy, Art, Science, and Immortality. The Morbid Anatomy Museum is an institution in Gowanus, Brooklyn. It was founded by Joanna Ebenstein and Tracy Hurley Martin. Been around for about 2.5 years, and it really is dedicated to the preservation and display of unique objects that tend to fall through the cracks of more traditional museums.
So let's talk about the collection that's on display now, which you curated. Mm-hmm. Can you just give us a little background?
So the current exhibition here at the museum is really about taxidermy. So taxidermy is sort of a category of objects that are familiar to everyone. I mean, pretty much everyone has seen maybe a taxidermy fox or a deer head on the wall in some hunting lodge in the country or something like that. But what we're really trying to do here is to try to illustrate and emphasize what makes taxidermy fascinating to so many people. It is certainly an obscure form of art, or some would say science, but there are a lot of aspects to it that have fascinated onlookers and enthusiasts more generally for well over 100 years. So most of the taxidermy on display here is antique. A lot of it dates from the Victorian era. And we have segmented it into a variety of categories that we find, and that I as the curator find very compelling, that kind of drive my passion as a collector. And I think, a lot of that, those sort of themes or genres of taxidermy are responsible for its sort of resurgence today as an art form and sort of something that hobbyists are increasingly taking up, both the actual practice of doing it and collecting more generally. One example is right here in the corner. So this particular piece, I believe it to be a fox that someone has shaved to look like a dog. It is absolutely horrible in terms of its look. Definitely falls into the crap taxidermy category. It's got these big goggle eyes that are not properly aligned, and it's sort of unevenly shaved. Its ears are beat up, and it just looks pathetic. But at the same time, as an object of intrigue, it is also very compelling. So I think that's one of the reasons why we have attempted here to sort of cut across broad swaths of these categories that make taxidermy compelling, because it's not just one thing. And really, taxidermy as a whole, there are just so many aspects of it that make it truly compelling. So a couple of other pieces that we have on display here. This is a dwarf calf. People think that it's maybe a bulldog or something. It actually has a form of dwarfism called bulldog syndrome, which gives it a very large and obvious underbite, so a protruding lower jaw, these tiny short legs that are only about 3 or 4 inches from the ground, and a very bulbous forehead. So it really literally looks like a bulldog, as the name implies. We've also got a two-headed piglet here and a two-headed kitten. This is a modern mount by one of the taxidermists in residence here at the Morbid Anatomy Museum. In this case, the two-headed kitten is also seen or depicted in a glass dome holding its own skull, which of course has two crania there, as you can see.
Oh, I see. So they took the skull out. Is that common to remove the skeletal structure?
Yeah, so good question. It is common. So most people, and I think we always have a lot of questions about this, what is inside? I mean, these are stuffed animals, as it were. What are they stuffed with? And it really depends on when the work was done and the materials that were available at the time. The technology for doing this has improved considerably. So you do see some pieces like this one. This is a very early piece from the early 1800s that's filled with sawdust.
And you're picking it up and the sawdust is coming out.
Yeah, the sawdust kind of rains out of it. And you can see its body shape is extremely elongated and not particularly naturalistic, because this was done in an era before you had more modern technologies and techniques for creating the internal form. So this piece is literally stuffed with sawdust.
You personally, does it make you think differently about mortality and the morbid things and death?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for me personally, I think it does. I mean, collecting taxidermy, I don't do taxidermy myself, but certainly as someone who has studied and who appreciates natural history more generally, and that's sort of my background from an academic standpoint, I think being involved in taxidermy or with taxidermy in this way has sort of changed my sensibilities around death somewhat. I would say that I probably have never thought about that before until you just mentioned it, but I think you do start to see it as part of a continuum a little bit more, and it becomes a less terrifying proposition. Again, I don't know if it's taxidermy per se, but I think it's just being around death, being able to talk about death, I think makes it a little bit more accessible and less terrifying.
Well, that was morbid, wasn't it? And you can catch the Taxidermy Show until the 6th of November at the Museum of Morbid Anatomy in New York. Such a thing does exist. Time for a bit of psychoanalysis now. We've met some of the people who are morbidly fascinated, but now we want to know why. One person who might be able to help us out is Bridget Rubin King. She's an assistant professor at the University of Central Florida and is the co-author of a study called Captivated and Grossed Out, an examination of core and socio-moral disgust in entertainment media. Basically, this means that she studies why people are so intrigued by things that disgust them on TV, in films, and on the internet. What is it that might urge someone to share a gruesome news video online, say of an ISIS beheading, or what drives us to put ourselves through the perilous journey of a horror movie? Producer Holly spoke to Bridget to find out.
Disgust is this very complicated emotion that responds to like just gross out humor, to like horror and gore, blood and guts, to things kind of more top down that require a little more effort to process, things like social moral disgust. We're disgusted by brutality, we're disgusted by sexual disgust, things like incest or abuse. So there's a lot of different things that disgust us, but kind of across the board, they draw our attention more than anything else. So it's that kind of rubbernecking that occurs. We're kind of motivated to pay attention to disgust, and I think for a number of reasons, largely because an evolutionary standpoint would argue that it is beneficial for us to understand what is disgusting so we know what to avoid in the future, right? So disgust started as this very basic response to don't eat that or don't have sex with that, to what kinds of people and practices to avoid. So it's very motivationally relevant. It's difficult. We're kind of hardwired to pay attention to things that disgust us so we know what to avoid, whether it be objects, people, or practices.
And so from that, have you seen sort of over decades that people are developing more fears, people find more things disgusting because they're perhaps exposed to more things through movies and TV and the internet?
You know, there's some patterns that we know from the literature, and it's typically that people get more easily disgusted as they age, actually. So that would kind of suggest the opposite effect than of a desensitization, where people become more sensitive to that content over time. And we see that, you know, when you see horror films like Hostel 17 or Texas Chainsaw 9, I mean, they're being targeted to younger audiences. But I think that we definitely have seen, with the explosion of so much television and so much film content in the most recent decade, certainly streaming TV, there's a lot more narrative drama content for us to consume than there was 10 or 20 years ago. And with that comes whole new ways of being disgusted. So there's a lot more content that people can choose from. And that certainly introduces some bizarre concepts of things that are horrible and disgusting and scary.
What does watching these things physically trigger within us?
Physically, it depends a little bit on the type of disgust. So things that affect us on a social moral level that require some thinking, those results we see a little bit slower in the body. But in general, our heart rate slows down as we pay more attention. And then when the disgust is highly arousing, then we'll see a quickening, a speeding up of the heart rate. When disgust is introduced in a high arousing context, we sweat more, right? So we can measure skin conductance or galvanic skin response. certainly, I haven't personally looked at eye tracking data, but I would imagine that pupil dilation begins to occur when we're completely captivated by something disgusting. And it, I mean, it's a fight or flight response, basically, that we have. It's a degree of response that differs. So we can watch a disgusting horror film with someone's intestines spilling out of their body, and we have certainly a more tempered response, but our body is doing the same thing as if we were in a room with a person with their intestines falling out of them.
And so when we've watched something like this, somebody's intestines falling out of them, which to me does not sound appealing in the slightest, why do people then come back to watching something similar? Is there an element of obsession or addiction to this, or is it just purely fascination?
I mean, I think that there's some variance across individuals, but I mean, just the simple principle of mere exposure in media is that once we see, we just like things the more time we spend with them in general. That goes for people, it goes for genres of content. If I make myself watch the news every day for 3 weeks, I like it a little bit more after those 3 weeks than on the first day because barring anything, we grow to like things over time. Disgusting content also is content that I would stress again, it grabs our attention, kind of whether we want it to or not. And so in that way, we want to keep going back for more because it's not boring. Boring content is the worst thing that any type of message producer, be it advertisements or entertainment, health-focused, boring is the worst thing that you can do to a message. Positive, high-arousing messages are great too, but short of everything being really positive and really exciting, negative and exciting content keeps our attention, so producers will continue to introduce it into content and viewers will continue to watch it and eat it up.
And some people you meet are completely avid horror movie fans, and then there's also the camp of absolutely despising them. Can you identify why some people are more morbidly fascinated by horror movies and sort of this type of content than others?
Not yet. I'd love to put together a profile of that. Others have come up with scales of disgust sensitivity, perceived vulnerability to disease and contagion, which is also rooted in disgust. And people have certainly put together demographic profiles. We know they tend to be slightly younger, slightly more male. But what actually gets individuals to be into the gore part instead of the suspense part, right? So if you're talking about kind of the grotesque or the dark in general, I also am not a horror fan, but I love dark mystery tales about serial killers. You know, there's tons of programming and books that I watch that are actually, and if you think about the topics, that's quite dark. But for me, I think it's tied, and for most audiences, what gets most audiences hooked is the suspense. And violence and gore are very easy from a producer standpoint to induce suspense. It takes actually much more careful plot and story and character development to have people on the edge of their seat without just resorting to, throw in some more intestines. So I don't know specifically what gets people more interested in that. I would imagine that it isn't just one factor and that over time, the positive things that you get out of viewing content like that are reinforced. So yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't think myself or the literature has a clear-cut answer to yet.
And I guess just sort of following on from that, being repulsed by something and being scared by something are quite different things, but both are tropes of your sort of classic horror movie. But do they come from the same place?
So fear and disgust are typically talked about both as basic discrete emotions, right? So we have anywhere between 4 and 7 discrete emotions that scholars kind of agree on. I mean, they're rooted in different, slightly different places in the brain, and I think they evolved from slightly different functions. But both are related strongly to our avoidance, our defensive systems, our aversive systems. And so, fear that start, basic fear that starts in the amygdala is the fight or flight response, is the get out of here. And disgust is a little more complicated. Disgust is also the last kind of basic emotion that we acquire through childhood development. We know fear from the beginning. You will know this if you've ever had to potty train a toddler. you have to teach people that some things are disgusting. And disgust is thought to evolve more from our oral rejection system. So what used to just teach us not what to eat has evolved into a general avoidance mechanism. So they're certainly action-oriented to varying degrees, highly arousing negative emotions. Disgust is typically tempered as disgust is a little less arousing than fear, but they're both very far on that negative side of the continuum if we put all emotions from, you know, very negative to very positive.
And just finally, why are people disgusted by different things?
Oh, because so disgust scholars have identified anywhere between like 3 to 9 different dimensions of disgust. Some of us are more disgusted by those base things. This is more highly individual. So there are some things that offend us across cultures, right? So incest almost invariably in the modern world is thought of as disgusting. But then there's plenty of different cultural practices about everything from touching other individuals, wearing used clothing, to bathroom practices, quite frankly. So there's a lot more variation that shapes those types of things. So culture and norms around you have some shaping of what you find disgusting. And some of us are just, as an individual trait, we are surveilling the environment for threats to a larger extent than others. So some of us have a more active, aversive, or defensive system. And so sitting next to someone coughing and blowing their nose might disgust me more than you, because I am just more wary of germs and do not want to get sick. And that really has some personality roots too. So it's definitely a contributions of several different things.
That was Bridget Rubin King, assistant professor at the University of Central Florida there. Now, before we go, we're going to play a clip from a recent big interview on Monocle 24 about a morbidly fascinated artist, James Ensor. Ensor, in his pomp at the end of the 19th century, is in a noble Northern European lineage, one of an unflinching way of showing things the way they are, warts and all. Even if there aren't any warts, put some on. Ensor's X-ray spec saw right through his subject matter. Portraits and jolly groups who, in different hands, might be something like Rembrandt's The Night Watch, jolly, chubby burghers of the bourgeois Low Country, are skeletons to Ensor, dancing themselves toward the grave. It's witty, weird, and wonderful stuff. Ensor is beloved by another Belgian artist, the contemporary maestro of painting, Luc Toymans. Toymans, also a man with a mission to show the truth behind the image, has curated a show of Ensor's work, which opened last week at the Royal Academy in London, and he came in to talk through his morbid fascination with another artist's morbid fascination. I love Belgian artists. Here's Luc Toymans on James Ensor.
There is always a clear lineage in Belgian painters, but I mean, I remember seeing Ensor when I was 16, when I still had the chance to see the other big painting, The Entry of Christ in Brussels, was in the same museum, and then was still owned by an Antwerp collective family. Actually, the residue of that lives in London now. And then it was, unfortunately, ended up in the Geddes Foundation, and we can't even lend it anymore. But one of the paintings that always struck me as a kid, and till this very day I think is one of the most powerful ones, is the one he painted 1 year later, which is The Intrigue, and that's for also the title of the show.
And The Intrigue, are you referring to one painting? Are you referring to your view on that artist?
Yes, it was a shocking painting, because if you then sort of try to think the times when it was made was firstly not very evident. One can think about Ensor as grotesque, and one can think about Magritte as surreal, but they aren't in a way. They deal with a certain type of reality, although the one of Ensor is a different one. But nevertheless, together with people like Munch, who created The Cry also, which is a painting on the dot, they were the clear precursors of Expressionism. It's also funny that actually now there is a very big show of abstract expressionism underneath my show, which is rather bombastic, but on the other hand, it also clearly shows what the CIA did as a covert operation.
It is, after all, underneath your show.
Yeah.
Well, people can read into that what they will.
No, and the other thing was that when Tim Marlow and Adrian Lockey asked me that, I was not very well aware that the British don't really know Ensor that well, which is quite shocking in terms of ignorance. I mean, we had Brexit and now this. So in a sense, I thought that was even more an instigation to actually go forward with it. And the good thing is that we are very lucky that the museum in Antwerp is still rehabbing and it's not open yet until 2019. And so we got really hold of the major works of Enzo, which is in particularly mostly in that museum we got from Brugge, Brussels and whatever else. But
so they don't normally travel? And we
these
have
paintings would have never traveled if the museum was open now.
I wanted to ask you about that. We talked about lineage just now and the idea of Enzo being a realist and Magritte being not a surrealist.
It's more the idea of the real, of how you make an interpretation of the real, in a
Do
sense.
Do they have X-ray specs? Because people think this about your work, Luke, that you also don a pair of X-ray specs when you go into the studio, that your canvases see through the flesh and bone to something underneath, which is something that people think about James Enzo as well.
Well, James Enzo, of course, there is also an element of a very political stance. I mean, when the work was made, Europe was a little bit in turmoil, as it is right now too, in a different perspective, of course, and other things are at stake. But I think what predominantly was occupying Enzo's mind was not only the grotesque, but also sheerly the element of populism, which came up in the days, you know, with socialist parties that came up. Those things were born around that time. And although he was fairly liberal, he was, of course, also a bourgeois. So there was an element of initiated and immediate fear against the crowd, in a sense. Now, the intrigue is, of course, a lesser crowd, and it's been said that it's also more a personal painting and that there are other things. But nevertheless, you can see that there is a Greek mask, that there is the one head with the strange hairdo, was actually a critique on a French judge who was pretty hard on free speech and things like that. So there are all these things, because, of course, he thought and pretended too late in life that it all fell out of thin air and he was a genius. But in fact, he also looked at the encyclopedia of the caricature of Jean Fleury, which was very instigating when he was a young man. So it came from somewhere. So it was also a little bit in the air to a point.
Is that one of those things, Enzo perhaps did this well, being an artist and looking like you're not trying?
No, but also he was against academism, fairly. He was a great, great painter. You will see that in the show I incorporated a lot of drawings where you can see the draftsman. And from early on, you know, there's one drawing of a self-portrait who was 18 years old. Well, that can make Picasso go home.
That was Luke Toymans speaking to me for last week's edition of The Big Interview. You can hear the full thing by downloading episode 48 from monocle.com on iTunes or on SoundCloud. Intrigue, James Ensor by Luke Toymans, is on at the Royal Academy of Art until the end of January. So, why are we all so morbidly fascinated? Well, some people are more than others. Perhaps an artist or a psychoanalyst has a job to be professionally intrigued by the dark side. Showing a bit of interest in the dark and grotesque doesn't make you a weirdo, though. After all, I love J.G. Ballard and managed to be almost 43% sane. It's not all about the things that go bump in the night. It's the way that our brains assess what's okay and what we should be disgusted by, and it's also the provider of cheap thrills as well as artistic visions. A little bit of morbid fascination doesn't always hurt. In fact, it might be able to do you some good. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was, of course, the spooky Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.